On Keeping the Faith this afternoon, we're going to be talking about Haydn's creation. Talk about chaos and creativity, and we're fortunate to have Kevin Kelly, who's going to be conducting the creation soon, and we'll be learning about that. And also, we're very pleased, we also have Chet Always to be talking about this. Now, Chet, you've got a concert tonight, and thank you very much for coming.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
And what's the concert tonight?
It's the Concert Choir Spring Concert, okay. You know, just our typical end-of-the-semester concert. So,
at Smith Music Hall, what are you going to be performing?
Oh, a whole bunch of 17th century sacred music and Messiaen and Fauré and 20th century and little Brahms. And it's a typical mix of stuff. So.
And that's at 7:30 at Smith, and it's free and open to the public. And where is Smith Music Hall for listeners who maybe have never been there? Matthews Street.
It's on,
right?
Matthews Street. Yeah. Right where Matthews Street turns east. It's one way south, and then it turns east. There's Smith Hall.
Right off the quad.
Yeah, parking's kind of scarce there.
And Kevin, tell us about your concert coming up with Haydn.
Well, it's a concert. It's an interesting collaborative concert, the Prairie Ensemble. It's on our final. It is the final concert of our concert season, but we're also collaborating with the chorus from Chet's other group, which is the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana, and this whole thing is also a part of the Whirlwind Project, the culminating event in that as well, on May the 6th.
And the Whirlwind Project, for those who don't know, is an interfaith project that includes Muslims and Jews and Christians and Hindus and others, and looks at a particular theme once a year in the spring. And this year the theme is chaos, creativity, and creation. And so Haydn's creation is certainly appropriate piece for that. You were telling me, Chet, before we went on the air that chaos is an important part of this.
Well, the piece begins that way. The oratorios of the day tended to have, and that was the tradition into the 19th century, even with Handel before that, they had overtures. But Haydn writes a descriptive, I guess you would call it, overture, which is, I told Steve, I thought was the most remarkable piece of music in the whole work, which is entitled The Depiction of Chaos. Mm. After which, you know, the creative activity begins. So out of this void, this mix of disorder, as it were, then Haydn proceeds to introduce order.
But knowing Haydn a bit, he was had such an orderly mind and was so prolific and created so much music. How could he do chaos, Kevin? How do you conduct chaos?
Innate.
Well, I think it'll probably be somewhat mellifluously. And he had a lot of rules to break in a way, or bend or stretch or whatever. You know, in his day, composers were supposed to have this sequence of chords and then with these kind of cadences, and he changes the rules a lot of the time, where you'll come up to something and think, well, this is what's going to happen next, and then something else happens, and it happens over and over again. It's really very disorderly according to the rules. And I think that's, I mean, it ends up sounding chaotic. I mean, in trying to learn it, it's sort of confusing because there's no real pattern to it most of the time. I mean, a little bit of it, though.
So Haydn had some surprises other than just in the Surprise Symphony.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, he was very good at that sort of thing, actually. Usually in a humorous way. Uh-huh. This one, humor is not an issue.
Okay.
Not yet. Later on in the piece, but not yet.
My teacher at Union Seminary, Richard French, used to say that with Haydn, there's always a joke. And it's indicating that it was often humorous. And that's really quite true. He liked to play with convention, as Kevin said. What you expect in classical music is regular phrases that do predictable things.
You
know, bum, 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 bum. Everybody else can finish the phrase because we all know how it works. Chaos is represented in a most original way by avoiding the one thing that creates order in music in the 18th century, and that's cadence. There is no cadence to the tonic until the recapitulation begins, so-called recapitulation, where the opening returns. So there's no real theme. There's no real key center that focuses. There's lack of cadence. There's a very free and unusual and very progressive approach to orchestration.
Now, this is WILL AM, not FM.
Oh,
so
I'm sorry.
Cadence and tonic, you'll need to say a word about, please, for me, if for no one else.
A cadence is a progression of chords that defines a key, usually a dominant to a tonic, dominant being the fifth root note of the scale and its associated pitches to the tonic or the central key of the piece. So that's the main device in so-called classical music that defines when you say a piece is in C major, for example, you expect a cadence from G that's dominant to C. And that's what I meant.
And it might sound like, you know, if you're singing bum, 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 one, yeah, four, five, one, you'd expect after the four to get a five, and then usually a one. But you wouldn't expect one, four, five, four,
or
would
six.
Be, yeah, anything other than the one would be not what you'd expect.
I see.
And he does this over and over again.
And this is true in all sorts of music, isn't it?
Yeah. The first prelude in Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier in C major, you know, he's the people from the Bach who know Ave Maria. The first four measures are basically, I say to my classes, this is the opening sentence of the piece, which is a one, a two, a six chord, a five, a dominant chord in first inversion, and a tonic. It says, this is C major. I am C major. It defines the nature of the piece, and then the harmony expands and moves different directions. But first of all, you have to be rooted in the tonality. And that's another issue that this piece raises, not only in chaos, but in the overall form of the piece, and that's that it begins in one key and uncharacteristically and, again, amazingly ends in another.
Hmm.
So that's a kind of lack of tonal unity that you expect to find in classical music.
Although, just to dredge up controversy, I have this little book here written by Chet's colleague Nicholas Temperley, in which he addresses that question. He says, well, maybe that's not so unusual that there's a number of other oratorios that do that. And I have to confess, particularly to Chet and any musicians who may be listening, that I tend to be very unaware of keys, you know. In Haydn's day, keys were supposed to have certain meanings.
Were very important.
The key of C meant this sort of feeling, and is that right?
Yeah, in Vienna, particularly in Austria, you notice most of Mozart's masses are in C major, and C major was the key of God. And when in this piece, C minor is the sort of doppelganger, it's the dark side, which is chaos. And then C major is the key in which God speaks, and when man is created in native worth and honor clad, he's created in C major in a sonata form. Can't get much more godly than that, I guess.
We're going to be able to hear some examples
that you brought.
Oh, good. Is this an appropriate time to hear a sample of that? Could you lead us into that, Kevin?
I think we just led into it.
So
this is the opening of the creation.
Very good.
Thank you.
Well, we've just been listening to the opening of Haydn's Creation here on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with our guests Chet Alwis and Kevin Kelly. Kevin will be directing the concert coming up on Friday, May 6th at 7:30 at Wesley United Methodist Church at 1203 West Green in Urbana. And not only this will Kevin be directing Haydn's The Creation, but also another piece that also, does it deal with chaos?
Well, it deals with the same creation story, so yes. It's by John Corigliano, who is a contemporary American composer, who wrote a piece called Creations, which, like the Haydn, is in a couple of parts. The Haydn actually in three parts. The first part of the Corigliano's Creations corresponds to the first two parts of Haydn's Creation, which is to say this is the part where God created everything. Seventh day came and he rested. The second part of the Corigliano corresponds to the third part of Haydn's Creation, which is Adam and Eve falling in love in the garden. And so Corigliano, because he is a 20th century, 21st century composer, he's still very much around, did not have the same number of rules and conventions that Haydn had. So many other techniques of composition have come and some of them gone, although really none of them ever go. I mean, once somebody has done something, it's fair game for anybody else to do it and add it to their own arsenal. And Corigliano uses quite a few different techniques. So his representation of the whole piece, in particular, the void, probably sounds more like what we would expect because we are of his century. And so anybody who has seen Star Wars won't be terribly surprised, or any other space movie for that matter, won't be terribly surprised at what the Corigliano piece sounds like to start with, or even at a lot of other places. Because if you think, you know, God creates out of nothing something, well, what does nothing sound like? So we queued up this part too.
Let's hear an example.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness. And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night.
So, Kevin Kelly, tell us a little bit about what we've just heard. Who is speaking?
Ian McKellen, and if you don't know the name, you probably know one of the characters he's played recently in very big-name movies. That is, if you've seen any of the Lord of the Rings movies, he was the character of Gandalf in there.
And who will be doing this reading at the night of your performance?
Roger Diggs, who is the pastor at Grace Lutheran Church in Champaign.
And who has a theatrical background as well.
He does. I'm told that now Chet would know because Chet directs the choir at his church. I'm told he does a lot of theatrics in his sermons at times.
Oh, I don't think you'd want to have him characterized as theatrics, but he doesn't preach in the traditional sense. He doesn't stand on the pulpit. He stands down on the floor and delivers his sermon without notes. So it seems, though it's not, it's scripted and sort of memorized, but it's extempore, as it were. But it has dramatic moments, and we have our yearly visit from Martin Luther, which is quite dramatic, yes.
Interesting. So we've heard two interpretations of chaos from the one from the 18th century and one from our present time. How would you characterize the differences? What is chaos in these two visions?
Well, in the case of the Corleano, it's probably easier to answer because it starts out with just this noise, you know, as though there really were nothing. I mean, it's just air. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, it's the chicken and the egg thing. What came first, mm-hmm. nothing or something? I mean, there had to be something to come out of nothing. You know, it goes back to the whole question: is there a God? You know, mm-hmm. And so Corleano, by having this misty sort of sounds, which are created in very strange ways through blowing through mouthpieces without actually playing the instrument and other things like that. And then he throws in these little eerie little peeps and things. Chaos is lack of any kind of organization, I guess.
Hmm. Now, Chet Alwis, in the courses you teach at the university in music, you bring to those courses not only a musical background but a theological training. How do you happen to have that?
I got my master's degree at Union Theological Seminary in New York City in the late 60s and early 70s, and I've always worked in the church. It's not so much a church background as a limited thing. It's more a cultural or contextual or historical kind of background. It's not limited to the church,
of course,
but history in general. I mean, as opposed to the history of music, it's the broader history of how that music is a reflection of the culture in which it was created.
Now, in an oratorio like Haydn's, back in the 18th century, what was he thinking about in terms of chaos, do you think, in terms of theology?
Well, Haydn must be said, first of all, and I guess most obviously to those of us who know the piece, was greatly indebted to George Frideric Handel, who had been the major composer in Britain in the earlier part of the 18th century. And Handel's music was still popular when Haydn visited there in the 1780s and 90s, and it's largely recognized that a performance that was given at Westminster Abbey, a kind of commemorative concert of Handel's music in the early 1790s, which Haydn heard, was the genesis point of this piece. And in fact, as I said to you before we went on air, it's even rumored that the libretto that Haydn set to music in German was given to him by someone who claimed this was a libretto that Handel was to have composed himself. So the libretto of creation originally in English, which is what Nicholas's work consisted of, was restoring that original English, because in the process of Haydn's composition, that English, which included passages from John Milton's Paradise Lost in Part 3, as well as biblical stuff, was translated from English into German, set by Haydn in German for the premiere performance in 1798. And then when it was performed in England, it was translated back into English from that German, but not into the original English, but to yet a different English version, which is why we have so many different English versions. And Kevin could probably say something about the version he's doing. And is it any different? It is somewhat different textually. That's one of the issues we certainly face in choral rehearsals all the time, is what text are we supposed to be singing here?
Yeah. What words do we use?
Well, my understanding is I haven't looked at all the editions. Nicholas Temperley has, and I've relied a lot on what he's had to say in his book. I think the edition we're using actually doesn't mess with the text so much as it does with the orchestra parts. Hmm. Ironically, we're not actually doing some of the stuff that he allows for. I mean, the orchestra that Haydn used was actually extremely large, and he had as many as 3 brass and wind choirs that he used at different times, sometimes all together when he wanted a really big bang. That shouldn't probably be mentioned during the creation, but
absolutely, it should. That's how the chaos begins. It begins with a big bang.
Yeah, that's true.
That big, loud C.
That's
That's long before they knew the big bang, but that's exactly what it is.
It was a precursor to the big bang theory. But it's really interesting. I find it very confusing. Which came first, the German or the English? I mean, the thing wasn't English initially, as Chet said, and. I was rereading Nicholas wrote a book called Haydn, the Creation, in which he compares some of the editions and also gives the history of it and analysis of it and so on. And he discusses in some detail this business of the text. And apparently the original text doesn't exist anymore. There is no copy that anybody had ever found. And so there's a certain amount of surmising going mm-hmm. on as to what the original one was. Mm-hmm. And I guess you can see in some of the sketches what happened when Baron von Swieten, who was the guy who did the translation of the German from the English, he had to try to make the German fit the same meter, essentially, the same syllabification as the English.
Mm-hmm. One syllable per note, roughly.
Pretty much, mm-hmm. yeah. The recitatives being a big exception. But then Haydn, who didn't know English very well, composed to the German. And then for the first publication, then somebody had to go through and put the English text in, which is what Swieten did, and then he found it didn't always quite fit the way he thought it was, because he didn't know when he redid the translation and then redid some of the English at the time that he was doing the German translation. He didn't know what Haydn was going to pay attention to. He didn't know what he was going to choose to emphasize.
Mm-hmm. Well, Swieten actually went so far as to provide Haydn with some suggestions about that, which Haydn did or didn't follow, as was his desire. But I mean, actually, there are a lot of notations that Swieten makes in the score that says he ought to do this, he ought to do that. And fortunately, I suppose Haydn chose what he wanted to do and what he didn't want to do.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon about Haydn's creation with Kevin Kelly and Chet Awas. Listeners who would like to make a comment or ask a question may call us. 1-800-222-9455 is the toll-free number. It can be used anywhere this program is heard, including on the Internet. If you're in the continental U.S., that's 1-800-222-WILL. In Champaign-Urbana, several lines can be accessed by punching in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. And if you've heard that some of the phone lines are down at the station today, that is accurate, but that's another line. These are working, so this is a live call-in program, and these lines are available. So we're happy to have your comments and questions. Let me repeat again when this concert is that Kevin's going to be conducting with the Bach Chorus and the Prairie Ensemble. It's Friday, May 6th at Wesley United Methodist Church, 1203 West Green, Green and Goodwin in Urbana. Tickets are $10, $8, and $5. Students and children, I guess, are the lower prices.
Right.
And where can people get tickets? At the door, but where else?
You can call us at 355-9077. You can also visit the website, which is simply prairieensemble.org. And any of the above will get you tickets.
Very good. And we have a couple callers waiting, but let me just mention one other thing that's coming up. On a one-hour radio show, of course, we're rushed for time, giving examples and talking. And if you'd like to hear a more extended discussion of both the composers and the creations, Haydn and Corigliano, with Chet Awas and Kevin Kelly, in addition, Nicholas Temperley, who's been mentioned on this program, That will be happening this Thursday, April 28, at 7 p.m. The concert's at 7:30 on May 6, but this discussion is Thursday, April 28, at 7 p.m. at the Hillel Foundation on 503 East John. That's the corner of 5th and John in Champaign. So a couple opportunities for more discussion. But let's go to line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I wonder, could you give us some available recordings that you'd recommend of these two pieces?
Well, that's an excellent question, and fortunately I see a couple CDs just floating around the studio. Chet, you want to go first?
Well, the Haydn, the one we played, which is the one that I own, and the one Kevin has too, I believe, is the recording made by Christopher Hogwood in the Academy of Ancient Music, which attempts to duplicate the resources, music that Kevin referred to instrumentally and chorally, of Haydn's original performance. About the Corigliano, I'll have to ask him who recorded that.
Sorry, I keep bumping my microphone off, trying to not cough into it. I'm having a little trouble today. I'll suggest it one other of the creation as well, since we're talking about English or German. One that I like very much that's in German is John Elliott Gardner conducting his English Baroque soloists, the Christopher Hogwood recording, which is in English and, in fact, uses the edition that we will be using, is on the Loiseau Lear label, and we're happy to spell that for you if somebody wants to call later. And then the John Elliott Gardner one, which is in German, is on the Archive label, A-R-C-H-I-V. The only recording I know of the Corigliano piece is on Telarc, and there's a number of other pieces of his on there as well.
As well. Let's go to a second caller on line two. You're on Keeping the Faith. Go ahead, please.
Good afternoon. I have a real silly question, I think, but I would really like to go to the concert, but I don't want to stand in line for hours. Is there any way one can get tickets ahead of time?
Sure. You can either call the phone number, and if you call in the next, within this week.
Yeah, I had done that and didn't get an answer or anything, so I wasn't sure, you know.
Aha, you're finding flaws in our system.
Let me give the number again for those who want to try again, and you may too. It's 355-9077. Is there a way people could leave a message?
Yeah, they should be. Did you get a message when you called?
Yeah, well, actually, you did a wonderful piece on the concert and all that stuff, so I got to listen to that. And afterwards, then I left my message trying to find out how we could get tickets ahead of time, because there are three of us sort of senior citizens, and we really would appreciate if we didn't have to stand in line.
Mm-hmm. And you left your phone number and name?
I left my phone number and name.
Okay. Well, you should get a call back.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much. And this has been – I stumbled on this program this afternoon, and it's just been so enlightening. Thank you so much.
Well, you should just listen every week. We are talking with Kevin Kelly, who will be conducting the performance on May 6th of Haydn's creation and Corigliano's creations. And we're also talking with Professor Chet Alwis, who has a concert later tonight with the concert choir at the University of Illinois. And tell us, what are you going to be performing?
We're doing 17th century sacred music by Monteverdi, Schütz, and Purcell, and then we're doing two contemporary French pieces, or one sort of contemporary and one real contemporary, Messiaen, Au Sacrum Convivium, and Cantique de Jean Racine by Fauré, and some love songs, and that's pretty much it.
People who live close enough to Champaign-Urbana to drive here by 7:30 can have a free concert.
Sure.
It's one of the great joys of being in this area, that there's so much excellent music that's available absolutely free through the School of Music, the various groups in town. It's just amazing. And that'll be at Smith Music Hall this evening, and I am right at 7:30.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Great. And I might mention that Chet, in preparation for that concert, came here in his tuxedo. So as you think about what you're hearing today, think of someone who's dressed to talk about such interesting music. Kevin and I, however, are in sweatshirts. So.
Yeah, well, Steve is anyway.
Yeah, right.
Steve, I just want to mention one of the reasons Chet is here is that he's actually preparing the chorus for creation, and I'm very excited about it because I was at the Baroque Artists of Champaign-Urbana's, or Bach, performance of Handel's Saul. We were talking about Handel's oratorios, and I told Chet later on that, I thought it was a very fine performance, everything about it, but the highlight for me was really the chorus, which I thought was just splendid. So it's
thank you.
Exciting.
And that's what I was referring to earlier in terms of Handel's influence on Haydn. I think that's what blew Haydn away. It was less the solo writing of Handel than it was the choral writing. He had never heard such large choral forces as the English had at that time, and this spectacularly dramatic, almost theatrical music. And I think he was trying to capture, and does capture, some of that almost literally in the final chorus of the second part.
Yeah.
Bum, bum, bum. Almost in Hallelujah, and he achieved it as the glorious work there that sounds very Handelian.
Now Haydn overlapped with Handel and also Mozart. No?
No.
No.
A little bit.
When was Handel?
When he?
Handel died in 1759. Haydn was born in 1732. Okay. Sorry, a little bit. And they didn't know each other, though.
And then also, but he did know Mozart and Beethoven. Beethoven was much younger, of course. But
actually, Swieten was someone who played, that Kevin mentioned, was a nobleman at the court in Vienna. Played a pivotal role for both Haydn and Mozart in exposing them to the music of Bach and Handel. Mm-hmm. He had a kind of a group that met at his home. It was called the Society of Associates, which sounds like an investment brokerage firm or something. But they did performances of earlier music, including Bach and Handel, and both Mozart and Haydn got to know that music through the auspices of Swieten. So he's quite an influential character.
And Mozart apparently said, "It was from Haydn that I first learned to write a quartet, a string quartet." Well, we're about halfway through our program today on Keeping the Faith. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program. Support for Keeping the Faith programs here on WILL is provided in part by the University YMCA at the University of Illinois. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the university, begun by students back in 1873, and since that time has been helping to develop student leadership by providing opportunities for social action and community service. Coming up at the Y very soon is our big recycling program. Concern for the environment has been a theme at the Y for about the last three decades. And starting the week of May 10, Dump and Run, that strange name for a program where students, instead of dumping things in dumpsters that still have value and use, may deposit them at the Y or in big collection boxes that we have all over campus and also in certified housing units, and keep them out of the waste stream. We save those things in huge semi-trailer trucks all summer, and then we have a grand sale at the Stock Pavilion at the university the first week of classes at the end of August. So if people would like to donate something, if you're listening in the community and you need to clean out a garage or an attic or a basement or closets, items of use from clothes to furniture to kitchenware, please consider bringing them by the Y the week of May 10 and throughout May, and we'll be having another collection day in July as well. But do consider giving those items to the Y. It helps us raise much-needed money when we have the sale, and people get great bargains at the great Dump and Run sale in August. We also accept cars, automobiles, pickup trucks, vans, SUVs. Instead of selling them yourself or trading them in, you can get a tax break by donating the item if you itemize, donating the automobile to the University YMCA. For more information, call me, Steve Shoemaker, at 337-1500 during the Monday through Friday. Well, let's get back to our talk about creation and chaos. Haydn just seems to be so... played so much. Richard Good played a sonata by Haydn with Don Upshaw at the concert at Krannert last week. I heard the Surprise Symphony on WILL-FM as I was driving over here today. Why? I mean, we know Haydn composed so much, but is it really all that good quality?
You want to handle that?
No, not really. Well, that depends your point of view. I've never heard anything personally that wasn't at least highly competent. Mm-hmm. I'm not a composer, so I don't think I really have any business saying most of the time. But of course, we do all make our judgments. I always think of Haydn in the trio of Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven is often among the more four-square of the three of them. And somebody will argue with that and say, well, that's not true or that's not fair. I can tell you that of the three, he's easiest for an orchestra to play, typically. And I can't really explain why that is. I mean, Mozart probably being the hardest and sort of notoriously so. You give Mozart to a young group and they're probably going to make hash out of it. and you give it to an old group, and they might make hash out of it too, unless. But I think he's got some great tunes. He's got a lot of wit. You know, as Chet said earlier, there's jokes all over the place.
Mm-hmm. And he lived to be 77, so he had a lot of time. And he started out, as I was reading about him, as a child musician, singing, and composed some things very early. But then to have done, let's see, what do I have written here? 104 symphonies, 96 string quartets, 24 operas, 16 masses, 3 oratorios. I mean, it just seems like overwhelming.
Yeah, well, he did things in bursts and fits and at different rates. I mean, for example, the last 6 masses, which are the real great masterpieces of that genre, and the two of the 3 oratorios all post-date his symphonic output. Mm. That is, they all come after the completion of the 104th symphony, the last of the London symphonies. So the thing about Haydn, I think, that is different certainly than Mozart, is that Haydn is someone who, as you indicated, lived a long time and comes to compositional maturity by a slow, often torturous progress. He couldn't have been too slow. Well, compared to Mozart, it certainly was.
Really?
I mean, the Sturm und Drang thing we talk about in sort of the mid-18th century, this Sturm und Stress, it's all this experiment. You know, what happens if I write a symphony in the key of F sharp minor, like the Farewell Symphony? Those kind of experiments were things Haydn was able to do, partly because he was employed by a court. And it's one of the other things that separates him from both, at least late Mozart and Beethoven, is that he was still under the patronage system. Hmm. He was Der Haydn, as the Esterházys referred to him. So, you know, he famously wrote all these baritone trios for the prince to play. And I said, I like that piece. Write me 6 more for next week, you know. There is a kind of accessibility built into that, and a kind of deferential, if you will, almost attempt to please one's patron, that is, to be sure, present in Mozart and Beethoven, but not to the same extent, I think, in Haydn.
And actually, the patronage thing, probably in a way, for Haydn was simultaneously constricting and freeing, depending upon which of his patrons, because there were a couple of princes, Esterházy, and one of them particularly liked music a lot and gave him a lot of freedom at the same time to compose. They didn't give him freedom to travel, which is why he only managed to get to England a couple times for a couple short jaunts. But and the fact that you're asked, I mean, if your patron loves music and you like to write it, that's already a happy little situation, you know. And so he was able to put out a lot. He was asked to put out a lot. And the baritone that Chet mentioned earlier, by the way, was not either a singer or the euphonium, the brass instrument, but this crazy kind of semi-string, semi-plucked instrument is very bizarre. But one of the princes played that, and nobody ever has since, really.
So Haydn had to write for it, right?
Spelled B-A-R-Y-T-O-N.
I see. Let me give the phone numbers again for our callers who might like to ask a question to our guests, Chet Alwis and Kevin Kelly. In Champaign-Urbana, punch in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, and these phones are working today in spite of other station phones that are out. Also, our toll-free line is working, 1-800-222-9455. And people who are listening on the Internet at WILL.UIUC.edu may use the toll-free line within the continental U.S. Happy to have your comments or questions for our guests. And let me repeat that our guests will be available to be heard live at Hillel Foundation this Thursday night at 7. That's April 28. Hillel Foundation is the Jewish foundation on campus for students and faculty. It's at 503 East John, the corner of 5th and John in Champaign. And our guest today on the radio will be joined by Nicholas Temperley, Emeritus Professor of Music, for that panel discussion on composers and creations, Haydn and Corigliano, both of whom will be played at the concert Friday, May 6 at Wesley Methodist Church in Urbana. Tickets are available. You may check out the website. Which was that website again?
PrairieEnsemble.org. PrairieEnsemble.org.
Or by phoning 217-355-9077 for tickets in advance, or tickets will be available at the door. And there will be a little discussion before the concert itself, right, Kevin? You'll be leading that at 7 o'clock at Wesley?
Probably.
On May 6th?
I mean, there will be one, but...
I've heard it advertised. So.
There will be one. I typically don't quite know what it's going to be until shortly before.
I understand.
Who knows? Chet may be giving it. He says no.
I don't think so.
Tell us about the Bach chorus. How many people are singing?
Well, we've enlarged it, and it's still changing. Sorry to say.
I was going to say, that's a good question.
Typically, we have around 36 to 40 singers in that chorus, and we wanted more singers than that for this performance, given the, as Kevin mentioned, the large orchestration. Mm-hmm. And I don't actually know the number, but it will be around 50, I think, singers.
Okay. And how big is the orchestra, Kevin?
You know, I just added that up the other day because when I was reading this book again and looking at Haydn's forces, I was thinking maybe we don't need a chorus that large because he was using like 120 players and 60 singers.
Yeah, he put the chorus in front of the orchestra.
Yeah. Well, and also his instruments weren't as loud.
That's true.
As ours will be. Uh-huh. I will make sure of that. No, the orchestra, well, I think we've got about 21 string players and about as many winds.
Do we have another example from either of these pieces that would be good for us to let listeners hear of? We played a bit of the beginnings. Is there any other part that might be useful to demonstrate anything we've been talking about?
Yeah, since we've talked about the choruses
so much,
I thought we might go ahead and play the one that is probably the best known from there. It ends the first part. Maybe I'll say I'm practicing for the pre-concert talk. Let me talk a little bit about what the sequence of events is that repeats itself throughout the creation.
Okay.
Once the overture is passed, you have three soloists who are angels. Gabriel, who is sung by a soprano, Uriel, who is sung by a tenor, and Raphael, as they would say in English, in England, who is sung by a bass baritone. And their role is twofold, primarily. One is to tell the creation story. We heard in the little bit of Corigliano's Creations, we heard somebody reading the creation story straight out of Genesis. And that's essentially what the singers do in what's called as the recitative, which is when it's kind of sung speech, usually just accompanied by a couple of instruments.
Telling the story.
They tell the
musically.
Story. Mm-hmm. And then one of the soloists, usually, maybe more, will then do kind of a poetic commentary on it. And this does not come from the Bible. This usually comes from either one of the Psalms or from Milton's Paradise Lost, paraphrasing from Milton's Paradise Lost, or using it as a model. And then, usually in another recitative or at the end of this solo bit, the soloist or soloists will then say, and now here is the heavenly choir to praise God. Hmm. And then the choir comes in and proceeds to praise God. That's basically the sequence. It doesn't always happen exactly that way, but pretty much throughout the 6 days of creation, that's what happens. And so the chorus's role most of the time is to praise God. And this is one of those big God-praising choruses. It ends part one after the end of the fourth day of creation.
Thank you.
Well, what have we been listening to, Kevin?
That was The Heavens Are Telling the Glory of God with Chorus, Gabriel, Uriel, and Raphael, the end of day four of creation, according to the book of Genesis, from Haydn's Creation.
And since this is being sponsored by an interfaith group that included Muslims, it might be interesting to point out that Moses was considered a prophet, an important prophet by people in the religion of Islam, and these books of Moses, as they're traditionally known, include Genesis, and so this story is referred to several times in the Quran, as well as in the Jewish Tanakh, the Jewish Bible, and the Christian Bible, of course. So all three major monotheistic religions in the world consider these stories seminal and very important. Still today. We have a caller waiting, and so let's go to line number one. You have a question for our guests? Go right ahead.
Hi. Yes, I tuned in late. But here's my question. I know this is interfaith expression, and I'm grateful for that. Since this program was called Keeping the Faith, is it necessarily a religious production? And I'll hang up and I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
A very good question. Can people who are not religious come to a program that quotes so much from the Bible and find it interesting?
Well, I would say that's up to the person. we don't. In fact, this is a question that actually does come up. I certainly with the Prairie Ensemble, and it may well with the Baroque artists too, because we both groups play most of the time, perform most of the time in churches. Mm-hmm. And I have heard that some folks think, therefore, we are religious groups or somehow religiously affiliated groups, and that neither of us is at all. Mm-hmm. It happens that the best concert halls outside of the Kranich Center or Smith Music Hall are churches. Mm-hmm. And we don't have ready access to either of those other places, so there you have it. That's where we can be. This concert is the last of four concerts in the Prairie Ensemble season that is called this year Heaven and Earth. Four concerts, two of which are on the secular side of the spiritual, I would say, and two, including this one, that are on the sacred side of the spiritual. Not all spiritual is religious. Mm-hmm. And I would venture to say that not all religion is spiritual. And so we're presenting this as a spiritual event.
Yes.
Just as many Jews, let's say, sing in choruses of requiems in which Christ is evoked, or in masses for that matter. Mm-hmm. And they may well just be taking this as a wonderful piece of music with
sure.
marvelous spiritual expression, and that's how we're presenting it.
Mm-hmm.
I would venture to say that Chet's and my religious outlooks may well be very different. Mine may be very different than a lot of other people who may be at the concert,
mm-hmm.
and that's not the point at all. The point is really the music and the message through the music, and if you want to pick up everything else, you're certainly welcome to.
But let me indulge myself just a moment, since I'm in a room with two conductors. Each of you do come from certain backgrounds. You bring different histories to this work. How do you form this musical experience? You're going to have a concert tonight, Chet. You're aiming for this one on May 6th, Kevin. Here's the conductor up in front, who's rehearsed with these groups and practiced with these groups and taught them what you want to teach them about how to interpret this music. That gives you so much power. How do you decide how fast to play? How do you decide what dynamics to use? I mean, of course there are markings in the score, but I just overheard you two discussing whether the piece we just heard, the cut we just heard, was too fast or not fast enough. Now, that makes a big difference, doesn't it?
Or just fast, which is something else together. I'm not sure where to begin answering that question. There's different answers too, mm-hmm. depending upon what kind of group you're working with.
Right.
I mean, even just generally working with a choir versus an orchestra.
Absolutely.
Certainly in a professional situation.
What's the difference?
Well, what I was thinking, and Chet may be thinking something else, is that choirs typically rehearse over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. For example, the Bach group I know rehearses every Saturday morning. Mm-hmm. The Prairie Ensemble Orchestra is not going to start rehearsing until 5 days before the concert.
I see.
And we'll do four rehearsals, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty typical.
Why the difference between vocal music and instrumental? Don't just look at each other. This is radio. We can't just have these meaningful ones.
Yeah, I know.
Well, it's truth be told, I think the reality is that historically choruses take a longer time to prepare and learn the music than instrumentalists, who typically sight read better than a lot of amateur singers, let's say. I mean, for example, I always say I wouldn't walk into an orchestra and say I'm going to play on your orchestra unless I knew how to play the instrument.
Yeah.
And read music. But people do that in choirs of various sorts all the time. Hmm. And so there is a longer learning curve, if you will. I'm not saying that's negative at all, because the experience that the choral singer has is richer in some ways for the length of that time they invest. Hmm. The other thing that's different between a chorus and an orchestra, of course, is that the chorus is dealing with text. Hmm. And the orchestra doesn't see that. They only see their own part. A lot of the things that we decide, the decisions we make, are determined by the composer, depending on the period of history in which the piece was written. In Haydn's day, there were a good deal of indications about tempo and dynamics and articulation, that kind of thing, but not nearly as many as in Corigliano's piece, I dare say, because as we moved forward in the history of time, this music can't be, you can't depend on, as a composer, on being the only one who's going to perform your piece, nor do you want to be the only one who's going to perform your piece. Mm. So as you publish something, you want it with enough information that someone else can recreate the piece accurately.
Mm. There's another answer to that, which is, I mean, those are both of the answers that Chet gave are practical, and so is this one, and that is money.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
It is very often true that chorus members are not paid.
So these are volunteers from the community who come out and may go through some kind of a testing process to see if they fit with the ensemble, see how their voices are, see if they can learn. But well, you're saying the instrumentalists are all paid professional musicians who do this for a living, or at least try to make a living at it.
Right. But although the Bach chorus people are paid, but it's
a nominal amount.
Yeah. It's a different kind of thing, because, well, I think the trick, Steve, is what you just said, that in most of the groups around here, certainly in the Prairie Ensemble, all of the players in it are either professional musicians or professional musicians in training, with mm-hmm. a few exceptions. Mm-hmm. And so they are probably next week playing in another orchestra.
Sure.
And then the following week playing another orchestra, mm-hmm. doing their three or four rehearsals, you know. Mm-hmm. Chances are most of the people in the chorus, now maybe I shouldn't even say that in reference to the Bach chorus, because there are a lot of people about whom you could say exactly that in the Bach chorus. They're either professional musicians or musicians mm-hmm. in training.
Yes.
But
some are not.
Some are not.
Yes, some are not. Some are just folks in the community who like to sing. I mean, the thing is about the voice is everybody carries that instrument around.
Yeah.
And it's up to you whether you want to learn to use it or not. Not everybody carries a French horn around. Mm.
It's a very profound question, and we've dealt with it, I know, and I suspect that you have too. When you hire an orchestra, you pay them more money than you pay the singers for less of their time, really, and how do you justify that? And one of the things I say, good or bad or right or wrong, is that the choral people will come out and rehearse and want this experience over a long time, and they want to give a performance, and they don't want to do it with piano or organ, mm-hmm. and they want to do it with an orchestra. And it was written for an orchestra, and the reality is that you're not going to get an orchestra to come out and volunteer the same way that folks are going to come out and volunteer to sing in a choir. It just doesn't happen.
When I was in Raleigh, North Carolina, I sang with the Raleigh Oratorio Society, and it was a large group, and we had that experience. By far, the majority of the people, I'd say 90%, were people who may sing in church or synagogue and maybe had sung in choirs when they were in college or high school, but who might only be singing once a week in that rehearsal, but they looked forward to those rehearsals. Mm-hmm. And that was a wonderful musical experience and a learning experience, even though none of the choir was paid at that. None of the oratorio choir was paid in Raleigh. The soloist would be,
sure.
who came in at the last minute like the instrumentalist. But the other pleasure for me as a singer was not having a solo quality voice, but having a voice that could fit in a choir, was to be part of an excellent, high quality musical experience that was beyond me.
Right. And that's a very spiritual thing. I mean, it's mm-hmm. a transcendent experience. Mm-hmm. It's something that is bigger than individuals here. I tell you a real quick story. I know we're running late on time here, but when I did Mendelssohn's Elijah back in the late 80s, I remember, this tells you everything you need to know, somebody in the orchestra came up to me at intermission and said, "This is a great piece. What's it all about?" Now, the singers in the chorus they knew what it was about because they had the text.
Sure.
But the orchestra had really had like a couple of weeks of rehearsal time at most, and they were most concerned about mastering their own part.
Of course.
They had no idea what the story was going about, but they got taken up in it anyway. And so that's the difference.
And what's the pleasure for the conductor?
Steve, we've only got a minute.
I always save the big questions till last.
Well, I mean, that's a huge question, especially if you're talking the difference between orchestra and mm-hmm. chorus. And I can get myself in huge trouble by saying much about it, so I'm therefore stalling. But, I mean, for me, the pleasure is in viscerally experiencing the whole thing. I mean, mm-hmm. as a conductor, you're not making the music. Mm-hmm. I mean, some folks may think you are. You know, you use the term power. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you're totally at the mercy of these musicians in many, many ways. I mean, they are also at your mercy to some degree, but it's experiencing that the sound, the spirit of it, you know, ideally channeling through you. I mean, that's mm-hmm. ideally what happens is, you know, it comes off the page, it goes through your heart and head, hopefully both, and then out your hands, and then infuses the players or the singers. And then it's up to them to take the rest.
That's a wonderful place to leave our discussion. We've been talking today with Chet Awas, professor of music at the University of Illinois, whose concert tonight at Smith Music Hall is at 7:30, a free concert with the concert choir, and with Kevin Kelly, who is director of the Prairie Ensemble, who will also be directing the Bach Chorus that night of May 6, Friday, at Wesley United Methodist Church at 1203 West Green in Urbana. Tickets are available. $10, $8, and $5 by calling 355-9077 or checking out prairieensemble.org on the web. That's Friday, May 6th, performance of Haydn's The Creation and Corigliano's Creations. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, a production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
It's a comfort to catch the news on the radio every day, but understanding it is harder. I'm Jim Fleming, and I hope you can join me for, to the best of our knowledge, you might discover how not to make a dirty bomb, the politics of James Bond, or why kids love violent fantasy games. Go behind the headlines with us on To the Best of Our Knowledge.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana.
Programming on WILL is funded in part by a grant from TK Service Center, 806 Perkins Road in Urbana, offering automotive repair on cars and trucks by ASE-certified technicians. In business since 1984, they perform computerized engine diagnostics, alignments, brake and suspension work, and other repairs. A shuttle service for customers is also available. The phone number for TK Service is 344-0800 or on the web at tkservicecenter.com.
Monday through Friday at 3, join us for Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Monday at 3, Americans have a variety of relationships with domestic animals, their adored pets, hardy workers, dinner. Host Gretchen Helfrich and guests examine the history of domesticated animals in America on Odyssey, Monday afternoon at 3, here on AM 580, WILL Urbana.